This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. Here's something just about everyone who lives in Vermont agrees with. The health of Lake Champlain is critical to the state's well-being. That's true from an economic, aesthetic, and recreational standpoint. What's more difficult to reach consensus on is how to clean it up and what to do to keep it healthy. The good news on that front appears to be the collective reaction from environmental watchdog groups that Julie Moore has been chosen by Governor-elect Phil Scott to be the new Secretary of the Agency of Natural Resources. Julie Moore brings extensive private sector experience to the job as chief of the water resources for an environmental consulting firm in Montpelier, as well as her previous work for ANR on Lake Champlain's cleanup. Julie Moore joins us now in our Colchester studios, and thank you so much for speaking with us. Congratulations on the new job.
Thank you, and thank you for having me here today.
And listeners, if you have a question for Julie Moore regarding lake cleanup, you can call us at 1-800-639-2211 or send a question to our Vermont Edition Facebook page. You can also email us at vermontedition@vpr.net. Julie Moore, you come to this appointment with almost 20 years of work on watershed issues, especially. Could you describe some of your scientific experience coming into this position?
Sure. I started my career at a Washington, D.C.-based environmental consulting firm working on issues related to combined sewer overflows and wastewater treatment, developing models of collection systems and helping communities identify places they could put best management practices into their systems to help prevent or reduce those overflows. I relocated to Vermont in 2004 and began working at the Agency of Natural Resources. My first job there was as the agency's regulatory policy analyst, meaning I did work on projects going through Act 250 and Section 248 reviews, and then was promoted to being the director at the Clean and Clear program, where I spent about 4 years working on implementation of the first generation Lake Champlain TMDL. In 2011, I left state service and joined Stone Environmental in Montpelier, where I've been leading their water resources practice for the last 6 years. And we're doing a variety of projects related to addressing stormwater runoff, working on agricultural water quality concerns, as well as supporting communities that may not have a wastewater treatment system but need to deal with wastewater in order to grow their downtowns.
Now, that first time around with ANR, that was under Governor Jim Douglas. Remind us in that long story of lake cleanup efforts, where were we in terms of policy and legal action in the mid-2000s when you headed up the Clean and Clear program?
Sure. So the initial TMDL for Lake Champlain, and that stands for Total Maximum Daily Load, which is a pollution budget for the lake in essence, was accepted by EPA in 2002 based on a long-term monitoring study and a lot of other modeling work that had been completed by the agency. The Clean and Clear program had its inception shortly after that, I believe in 2004, and with a commitment from the Douglas administration to spend something on the order of $125 million to address lake water quality issues. This was based on initial estimates from the agency program, affected agency programs, not only in natural resources, but also with the agencies of agriculture and transportation. And so we were well into that work, starting to realize that it was probably a much more significant effort and undertaking than we had initially envisioned, and looking at what else was needed to really start to move the needle on water quality. Obviously, we're also, during that time, are battling against sort of increasingly wet and more intense rain events. And most of Lake Champlain's pollution occurs as a result of runoff from wet weather, frankly. It's not coming out of the end of a wastewater treatment facility. It's coming off the landscape. So the more it rains and the more intensely it rains, the more pollution we see.
So at the time, what were your biggest concerns about the health of the lake? Have they changed much since then?
Yes and no. The biggest concerns are obviously the impacts of harmful algal blooms. The blue-green algae that we see in the lake is capable of producing a toxin. The toxin has impacts on recreation, from human health impacts to impacts on folks' pets. It also has the potential to impact drinking water supplies, as we saw with the city of Toledo a couple summers ago in Ohio. So those impacts haven't really changed. I think that the challenge is sort of some of the exacerbation, maybe for lack of a different word, that we're seeing with the dramatic variations in our climate. Within the last 18 months, we've seen record high and record low lake levels, and those sorts of swings, you know, they produce different challenges for management. And I feel like the dynamic nature of the system is just growing as we move through time.
The intensity of things really has picked up. Same issues, but really more intense.
Correct.
Your private sector work with Stone Environmental included a close examination of the Missisquoi watershed. What did your work uncover there?
Sure. The work we did there was what we termed a critical source area study. So we were looking at areas of the landscape that disproportionately would contribute phosphorus pollution. We were making no commentary on the way the land was being managed. It was really looking at the combination of soils, slopes, cropping system, if it was in agriculture, and proximity to surface water as the key drivers for what determined which parcels were the most risky. The idea being, and as we know, lake cleanup is very expensive, but if we're able to target our resources to those pieces of the landscape that are the most sensitive, we should be able to have a much more significant impact. In fact, our study found by targeting our resources to the most sensitive places on the landscape, we could have three times the impact as opposed to if we just sort of randomly distributed our resources across.
Fair to say that this Missisquoi watershed then was kind of a canary in the coal mine in the sense that you're looking at this very sensitive area where a lot of problems have cropped up and saying, look, if we can target what's happening here, we can deal with the larger issues.
Yeah, absolutely. It's certainly one of the lakes that shows the most profound effects of phosphorus pollution and therefore a critically important area to focus on.
You know, that same report resulted in a legally binding agreement that the Conservation Law Foundation entered into with the Agency of Agriculture, mandating the state to impose more rigorous management practices on Vermont farms, large and small. Now, some Vermont farmers have felt unfairly targeted as a result. Are the state's farmers being asked to carry the appropriate burden when it comes to keeping the lake clean?
I think that there's a significant burden that all Vermonters, frankly, need to carry. I think the challenge is trying to figure out how to do it in a way that's meaningful for water quality without having a devastating impact on the way we use the landscape. We're learning as we go, so to speak. And I think over time, as practices become more familiar and more widely adopted, we're seeing the changes ultimately we want. But change is hard. Sometimes farmers don't have the tools they need to be able to implement these practices readily. And I know that can be frustrating to them as well because their time is their most important resource and it's finite.
Sure. And that's true, I think, especially for small farmers. But what about the disproportionate impact that the large farm organizations have?
Right. I would say large farms have, and by and large, been leaders on a lot of this stuff, looking at new technologies and trying new practices. I think that there, you know, we still have room to go and improvements that need to be made. And it's important that we sort of can get to that point where everybody feels like they're on the same team and pulling in the same direction. It's much more challenging to make progress when you're looking, you know, not only to farmers, but individual homeowners and businesses to make changes in their individual behavior that cumulatively will lead us to the water quality conditions we all really want in Lake Champlain.
Are there some particular improvements that you already are thinking of that you could possibly implement?
Wow. That's a tough question 36 hours into the job. I mean, certainly there are efficiencies and opportunities I see in a lot of places. I'm really excited about the project that I know Green Mountain Power is developing, looking at a community-scale biodigester facility in the St. Albans Bay watershed. I think that has some important opportunities, both on the economic side of the equation as well as on the water quality side of the equation. Work that's being done in some of the communities in Chittenden County, in particular the city of Burlington, is looking at integrated planning, which would help integrate their thinking about their wastewater, their stormwater, and their combined sewer systems, trying to figure out which of those projects are the best overall for water quality and do them first, as opposed to, you know, trying to have a scattershot approach, which in the end may achieve the same result, but certainly not get there in a way that's as meaningful to the folks who want to use the lake.
Yeah. We're speaking with Julie Moore, the new head of the Agency of Natural Resources. If you have a question, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Julie, you touched on this just before a little bit. The EPA has estimated a price tag over 20 years for cleaning up Lake Champlain, about $1.3 billion. But there was a recent study out of Dartmouth College and UVM that said the guidelines that EPA put forth for lake cleanup are actually not strict enough because the agency didn't take into effect the effects of climate change. You touched on that briefly. How much do you think climate change should factor into assessments of the lake's health going forward?
I think it's an important sideboard for anything we're doing when it comes to Lake Champlain. The changes in climate are significant. There's also a significant amount of unknowns when it comes to what the future holds. And so I think we need to have approaches that are adaptive and flexible. There are practices we're talking about right now, whether it's in the built environment or the agricultural environment, that make sense regardless of the climate solution, and will have benefits and potentially larger benefits if implemented correctly.
Did you have an opinion on that study when you heard about that?
I actually sat through a presentation yesterday by a couple of the key researchers from UVM where they explained that there's they've run a whole series of different climate models, and they've got a range of results. And on the worst case end of the scenario, it certainly looks like it would. Climate change has the potential to overwhelm what we would be doing on the landscape. On the other end of those climate change scenarios, it looks like we may be doing more than enough. And I think it's understanding the unknowns that contribute to that range and what we need to do to be prepared for those unknowns.
Let's talk again about everybody's favorite acronym, TMDL, which you explained means total maximum daily load. And this is what you said is basically how much the lake can take, you know, in phosphorus and runoff pollution. Why is that amount of TMDL so hotly debated?
Well, so, you know, you would think the TMDL, some people would think the TMDL would be zero, right? We don't want any phosphorus in the lake. And, and that's not true. There's some amount of naturally occurring phosphorus that's always been in Lake Champlain. Phosphorus comes from tree leaves. It comes from grass clippings. It's endemic in our environment. The total maximum daily load says how much phosphorus can we have without having an adverse impact on water quality, without having blue-green algae blooms. And that number, it's there's science that contributes to it. There were visual observations made of the lake throughout the 90s when people felt conditions were particularly aesthetically pleasing that contributed to it. So there's both qualitative and quantitative factors that went into the criteria that determine what that number is. And it's a really difficult number to pin down. We have an enormous watershed that drains to Lake Champlain. I saw an interesting graph the other night where somebody had said, you know, if the size of our watershed, which is extends into New York and Quebec as well as half the state of Vermont, was proportional to the size of the watershed draining to the Great Lakes, it would only be the Winooski River Basin. Wow. Our watershed is, you know, 10 to 12 to 15 times larger on a per square meter of lake surface area than most of the other major lake watersheds.
You know, as a scientist, I'm betting here that you would want to just concentrate on the science of your job, but you know there's going to be other factors coming
Absolutely.
Into this. So much of what you'll be able to do in this position as head of ANR is dependent on funding, both
Yes.
at the state and federal level. Along with the praise that you've received from some environmental groups is skepticism from them about comments the incoming governor made about not wanting to raise taxes to pay for Lake Champlain cleanup, his hopes that perhaps the Trump administration will relax some requirements related to TMDL. And you're faced with a really big task here. Are you concerned about having the money and resources that are needed to clean up and keep the lake healthy and essentially do your job?
Yeah, obviously, one of my first orders of business is to get up to speed with the work the current administration and the Treasurer's Office has done related to Act 64, which is the Vermont Clean Water Act, but also includes the Clean Water Fund, which would be the primary source of funding for lake cleanup. In my role at Stone, I've been following this issue, but I need to come at it with a new lens at this point and look forward to taking that opportunity. I do think I would like to clarify, I guess, a little bit of,
sure.
of what the governor-elect had said regarding the Trump administration. Clean water is going to be a priority for this administration, sort of regardless of what happens in Washington. And I would like to think that my appointment really shows that he takes water quality seriously and it is his priority.
So when you're looking at some of the numbers about, you know, estimates about what all this could cost, is that something that you're not going to want to have to worry about? In other words, you're not going to have to want to go to the governor and say, I need X amount of money here. You know, you're not giving me that amount of money. How are you going to approach those things when it comes to saying, look, this is what we need to do to clean up this lake and keep it healthy into the future?
Yeah, I think we are going to be looking at the proposals that will come out of the treasurer's office for lake cleanup and ways we can support those strategies.
Mm-hmm.
For example, and with the important caveat that we don't compromise the state's financial footing or overextend our capacity, there are probably financial tools. I'm thinking specifically like clean water bonds that we could use to make the investments in a long-term solution.
And there's far more to ANR than Lake Champlain, of course. What parts of the agency will be, you know, new areas for you to learn about and to work on?
Sure. Well, certainly everything related to water is sort of where I've spent the bulk of my career.
That's your wheelhouse.
It is my wheelhouse. That said, when I did serve as the agency's regulatory policy analyst for 3 years, I had the opportunity to work across not only divisions but also departments, looking at, you know, deer yards with the Fish and Wildlife Department, looking at some of the issues with high elevation timber harvesting with the Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation, as well as air pollution and waste issues out of the Department of Environmental Conservation. So I do look forward to getting back to that sort of breadth of scope in this role.
Julie Moore will be the new head of Vermont's Agency of Natural Resources. Thank you so much for coming in and taking the time to speak with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Up next, adoptions in Vermont are at record numbers. We'll find out why with the head of the Lund Family Center in South Burlington. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. The lack of permanence in the foster care system is a well-understood problem. Ideally, kids should be in stable, loving, permanent families, but sometimes the path to adoption is long and difficult. That's why it's notable that the number of total adoptions in Vermont this year is higher than it's been in years. By the end of 2016, this month, a total of 264 kids will have been adopted in Vermont, and that's up from 179 last year. The Burlington Free Press reported on the trend this week, and we've asked Wanda Audette to join us today to help us learn more. She's the director of adoption at Lund, a private nonprofit that partners with the state to facilitate adoptions of kids in state custody, and Lund also helps with private adoptions. Wanda Audette, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, you were in court in Orange County just this morning, I understand, to finalize three adoptions. Is that emotional for the families, the lawyers, all the people involved, or is it mostly just paperwork by this time? You know, you're getting to cross all the T's and I's, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. It's a very emotional process because it's really the end of a long road and process that the families have gone through in working, being foster parents and working with the Department for Children and Families to ensure the safety of the child while they're providing foster care, in hopes that the supports and services that are provided to the birth parents, that they can work on their case plans, and that if the child could safely be able to go back home again, that is what the department wants to be able to happen. And when that can't happen, and termination of parental rights needs to happen, and the foster parents are going forward with an adoption, to get to this day is really an amazing celebration. And so we had three adoptions today, and they were very emotional. At times, the judges can even, you know, cry, you know, from the process, because when it gets to that point, we have to do a finalization report that encompasses the child's journey in foster care, and it can be a pretty tough read.
Even the judges, that's quite remarkable.
Yes.
Yeah. Adoption cases can take a few different forms. Explain the difference, if you would, in circumstances between private adoptions and adoptions of kids who are in state custody.
Okay. A private adoption works when a potential birth parents or people that are considering their parenting options, and they may give us a call at Lund and say, look, I'm not really sure that I'm in a position to be able to parent my child, and I want to look at what those options are. And they get options counseling from us. And if they want to make an adoption plan, they are then allowed to choose a family that has gone through a home study process and had all their clearances done, and they're approved and awaiting family to adopt. And the birth parents can then choose that family, and then the state's not involved in that. It's a direct placement that the birth parents make through our agency at Lund to then the prospective family that they have chosen.
Now, to look at this from a sort of a numbers perspective, then, I mentioned some at the top, but you told us that in just the last 4 months, Lund has worked on 115 adoptions. 110 of those were kids in DCF custody. What is driving that number of adoptions of kids in state custody?
Yeah, it was actually 105 of kids in DCF custody from the September 1st to it'll be December 23rd. And it really is the opiate crisis. Hmm. The number of children that are coming into state's custody due to the opiate crisis is really raised the need that we have for foster homes. And then if parents are unable to work the case plan that DCF has set out for them, then, then there are time periods. And when the time periods aren't met for the birth parents, then children really need to have legal permanence. Kids are seeking that. They want to understand stability.
Right. So, Wanda, is this kind of a bad news, good news scenario in the sense that bad news, obviously, it's the opioid crisis that is driving this, these numbers of high numbers of kids in DCF custody being adopted. But the good news, I would imagine, is that they are being adopted. Those numbers are up.
It's both. The good news is that when a child can get that legal permanence and understand that stability and that they're going to stay there, that they're not going to move around, that this is going to be their forever family, the families are going to be able to get support services so that if something comes up for them, because, unfortunately, the children that are coming into state's custody, they're coming in because of abuse or neglect. And so there's some trauma that they carry. And so we want to make sure that if they cannot go back home in a timely manner, that then they can be adopted and that we can get the adoptions done for those children as soon as possible so that they can really start the healing process.
Are most of those people doing the adopting? Is there a range from, let's say, other family members, maybe a grandparent, or just people from outside the traditional family there?
Yeah, kinship placements are really on the rise. The numbers this year are going to range between 43% and 47% of the adoptions that are done through the Department for Children and Families are going to have been with kin.
How many kids are in foster care who could be adopted about?
Well, right now we have 121 cases that we are currently working on because it's not an easy process. And so we have 121 kids who are legally terminated, and the families that are interested in adopting, they have to have trainings that have to happen. We have to go through, record checks. We have to do all of their, legal paperwork to get them prepared to be able to go to court. We meet with the children so that the children understand, that they're going to be adopted and what adoption means. The new law where there's post-adoption contact agreements that are available for birth parents who they're going for a TPR, but the birth parents haven't been successful in working their case plan, but that they want to do a voluntary relinquishment of their parental rights, and with the opportunity in that they can have some type of relationship with their child and their new family into the future. And so we have to get all of those kinds of things in order. Also today, we have 80 children here in the state of Vermont whose parental rights have been terminated and they do not have a forever family. And we are in our partnership with the Department for Children and Families, Project Family, are working with those youth to find them a forever home.
Are we seeing a range of ages here, like, very young kids to some older kids?
The 80 waiting kids are between the ages of 7 and 17. The 120 that are in a foster home that is going to adopt them range from infancy to 15 years old.
knowing the kids are in state custody due to difficult family situations, what work does Lund do with the biological and adoptive families to make an adoption as successful as it can be?
Lund also has a residential treatment facility for women who are pregnant or parenting. And so women that are trying to work on their case plans to have their child come back home, they could come into our residential program and get support services. We provide counseling to birth parents to talk to them about, you know, their options, what they would like to have for their child in the future. If we're going to do a post-adoption contact agreement, we talk about what that relationship is like. And for our adoptive families or our pre-adoptive families before the adoption and after the adoption, once we provide the adoption and support services for them, we are then available to those families providing post-adoption support services. The Department for Children and Families has several agencies around the state of Vermont that provide that support services to families that are joined by adoption.
Wonder, what are some of the common questions you may receive from parents who want to adopt but are nervous about it, who don't know if they can handle it? It is a huge life-changing responsibility.
It is a huge life-changing responsibility. Well, you know, if people are interested in, you know, adopting through the Department for Children and Families, going to work and doing foster care first, what we always say is to, you know, to give us a call, to give the resource coordinators a call within your county, your district that you live in, and talk to them. There's training that's available. People are not alone. It takes a village to raise a child. And we talk about all of the supports and services that are available. Right now in Vermont, we are in desperate need of foster homes. The number of children that are coming into custody due to the opiate crisis and the lack of homes for kids to go to, whether it's a day or a lifetime. But if people want to get involved, they should call, they should get the information, they should get the training that is available to them. And, you know, we can be able to sort of help people and support them.
Yeah, we're going to have some contact information on our website. You can go after the show to vpr.net and find some of that contact information there. Wanda, what about the children in these situations? I mean, it has got to be so difficult for them. They're being taken away from the only home they've known, but it's a bad situation. Did they have a say in any way about where they're going, how they're feeling? And is that taken into account when you're talking about placing a kid with a prospective adoptive family?
Well, I think it's a range of, you know, how old is that child? If the child is older, certainly, you know, you have a, you know, that immediate need for a move that has to happen. And so a child may go into a temporary situation. The department looks first to family, you know, who is available to that might be able to take this child and make sure that they can work with the department and the child can be safe. You know, if the child's older, we talk to them about, is there anybody that you know, within the community that, you know, we could, you know, look at to be a potential option. But, you know, we're really wanting to look at also safety. You know, it's important that these children are safe. If they're being removed from their birth parents and in that situation, you know, we just want to make sure that the next places that they go are going to be safe places.
I hate to make you speculate here, but given what we're seeing in the current situation, which you described as desperate due to the opioid crisis, do you see the number of kids who are going to need to be adopted rising in the near future? Do you see any letdown in these numbers?
Well, a year ago, we started seeing the numbers increase, and we thought, okay, you know, we're going to do this, and we're going to, you know, it's going to be 6 months, it's going to be 3 months, we're going to get through it, and it just seems to be skyrocketing up. I don't see the numbers going down for a couple of years.
Again, I guess my final question would be, if people think that it is time to adopt, it is the right thing to do, what should they be thinking about first?
They should, you know, give us a call to have a conversation about what it means to, you know, be a foster parent and be willing to work with the birth parents to first try to get that child to be able to go back home again. And if they can't go back home, that then they would make the commitment to adopt them. If people don't want to do foster care and they want to do straightforward adoption, then they can give a call and go through that home study process to do a private adoption. But, you know, the first thing is really to get the information.
Wanda Audette is the director of adoption at Lund, the private nonprofit that partners with the state to facilitate adoptions of kids in state custody. And she's been explaining the brisk pace of work that Lund and DCF have been doing to finalize adoptions before the end of the year. Wanda, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Just ahead, printmaker Sabra Field and writer Julia Alvarez join us to share their new children's book that helps explain the concept of death to kids. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb, in for Jane Lindholm. Two celebrated Vermont artists have come together to address a very delicate problem: how to help kids understand and cope with death and grieving the loss of someone they love. Author Julia Alvarez and woodblock artist Sabra Field are collaborators on the new book, Where Do They Go? And they both join us now. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Mitch.
Thank you, Mitch.
Okay, my first question, and I guess I'll give it to you, Julia. Why in the world would you want to tackle such a heavy and delicate subject for kids?
Well, it's interesting because I've heard all the advertisement, and not just from VPR, but, you know, from the publisher, that this is a book for children about death. And I say it's a book for children of all ages about death. And it really came about because I'm in that demographic where we are losing our parents wholesale, whole generation falling away. And then about a year and a half ago, I lost my sister to suicide. And that really was a difficult one. And I found that I was reduced to a child's questions. Where do the people I love go? Where do the qualities they embody? What happens to that? And I think grief strips you down to that core child self. And so even though I think it is a book for children as well, it's also for the child in each of us when we're grieving. And we have unanswerable questions about loss.
Sabrefield, did you have any reservations about tackling this topic?
I had no reservations at all because I'm a Julia Alvarez fan.
and let me interrupt. I am a total Sabra Field fan. I wake up in the morning and wake up my husband and say, look at the Sabra Field sunrise.
And who contacted who to get this project started? Do you remember?
It was Julia.
Yeah, your idea, Julia?
Oh, yeah.
She had already finished the poem.
Oh,
right,
so okay.
But I knew only two people whom I wanted to be the illustrator. One of them, Goya, and he wasn't available. And the other one was Sabra Field, because I had just, in my grief, also just felt such comfort from her Demeter suite that she has about the myth of Demeter and Persephone and that loss. And so I said, I've got nothing to lose. I've already lost the biggies. I'm going to write a fan letter.
Well, Julia, as Sabra just mentioned, it reads as kind of a poem. It's really a beautiful book, and I really urge everyone to read it. Why did you feel, though, that pictures would be important here to bring into the telling of this story and then contact Sabra to do those?
Well, maybe it was because they were those simple, stripped-down child's questions. And because I got such comfort, I would go to the library here at Middlebury College and look at some of the prints of that suite that were on the walls there, and I would feel comforted. So I always felt the accompaniment of visual as well as, the words was important with the book. So I really wanted Sabra to do this book.
Well,
I was very, very glad she did.
Yeah. Sabra Field, just taking a look at the very first page of this book, the line says, when somebody dies, where do they go? And you have a picture of a child releasing a balloon into the air. How did you approach the telling of this story, that in particular? Did these images come to you immediately? How did you feel like you wanted to tell this in pictures?
You know, that's the only image in the book that doesn't come from a line that Julia wrote, but she set up the situation so that when I looked at the whole suite of poetry of hers, what I was taken with was how it reminded me of the grief a child feels when they accidentally lose a helium balloon. So the child is not letting go of it on purpose. It escapes from him or her. And where does it go?
No one knows.
No one knows.
It's remarkable. As the parent of a child who's 8 now, I remember when she was 3 and 4. And, of course, every child at that age will lose a balloon at some point. And she just started crying uncontrollably. She didn't understand where could this thing have possibly gone.
Yeah.
That metaphor is incredible. And since none of us know what happens when we die, these are the questions that are being asked in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Do they go where the wind goes when it blows? And then there are beautiful pictures of leaves, fall leaves, fluttering in the wind here. Sabre, you've done so many landscapes. You're known for that. You've also done other images, but not a lot of faces, at least in the work you're most well known for. Was it difficult to do so many close-up faces on woodblock for this particular project?
Oh, gosh, no. Faces are just – they're like mountains or trees. You just try to figure it out.
And Julia Alvarez, this is a series of questions in this book. That's what I love about it. There are no answers. There's just these questions. Did you write it as a poem, or were you thinking more of it as a book when you started out?
Well, I wrote a little piece, actually, about writing Where Do They Go, called Where Did They Go Come From? And it just came to me as a question one day. After losing my sister, I just didn't want to write, didn't really want to read, seemed my spirit was restless. And then one day, it's as if the poem came to me. And it came to me in the form of that first question, when somebody dies, where do they go? Hmm. Who can I ask? Does anyone know? And then it just kept going round and round in my head, and I'd think of another question to add to that one. And so I had little scraps of paper all over the house, every time I thought of another question. And it only occurred to me later to put them together and think of it as a whole poem or I love the word that Sabre just used, a suite. There was music to it. It was definitely a rhyming a poem with incantation in it.
This also seems like a book that made a conscious effort to make it multicultural. There are all sorts of faces in this book, Sabre, welcoming to all kinds of kids. There's a lot of detail. Was it difficult to be that detailed in your work here?
Well, when you say detail, you mean something like the snowflakes that you're looking at?
Yeah, I'm looking at that right now.
Well, the snowflakes are just a few knife cuts or cuts with a gouge, we call it. It's a kind of a chisel. So positioning them, thinking about getting the registration accurate or at least not distracting, that was important. But the facing page there, Mitch, that's stars. And, I pull that trick a lot. You just take a drill and hit the wood block with a drill and you got a star.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, it's just that easy.
Yeah.
Yeah, she makes it sound so easy.
She does.
Come on, Sabre.
I think, too, with the writing, Julia, this is more difficult than it looks. Again, these are a series of questions, but they're so poignant and beautiful. The snowflake page, again, we're talking about, where do people go when they die? Can I catch them as snowflakes on the tip of my tongue? Are they that quiet feeling at the end of a song? And this book is so colorful, too. It's not a morose book. This is not something anyone should think that, it's such a heavy subject. It's absolutely filled with color. And it can be, I know this sounds strange, but uplifting. Julia, do you think that that's possible in a book that's about death?
Absolutely. I think that each of those images that Sabre so beautifully put down on the pages of this book and the little moments in nature and amongst people that the child's questions lead us to, that all of those are in a way already providing the quote-unquote answers of how do we fill up that loss. Each of these little moments is a very special moment, and that is indeed, well, I'm not, spoiler alert, I'm not going to give away the ending.
No, I won't do that either. I want people to read this and they have that curiosity. You're also releasing the book in Spanish, I understand. Why do two versions?
Well, Seven Stories is a wonderful little independent press out of Brooklyn. And they do, you asked about multicultural images. They do a lot of multicultural books, and they also do a lot of social justice books. They did they just published a Bernie book. And I think they were, you know, they did want to reach a Spanish-speaking American demographic. And so I happen to be related to a wonderful poet, Rina Espaillat, who writes in English but is a beautiful translator. And so it was just the perfect storm. Sabra, Rina, Julia, we were onto this, and a great press and a wonderful, I mean, while we're doing this, it really was a collaborative effort. Stuart Bernstein, our agent, was our angel too. He really he really took this book and connected all the little pieces together.
Saberfield, I want to ask about, and it's going to be difficult for me to describe it because it's so moving, it might get me a little choked up here, but there's one page where you see a little boy and he's saying, will they answer my questions? Will they still hold my hand? Will they say not to worry if I don't understand? And he's reaching out and we see the white, just a white silhouette of a woman. Well, you can imagine that's his mother, perhaps, that he lost. Why do that, a white silhouette? How did that image come to you?
Well, you know, I'm not quite sure how I happened on it, but of course I drew the outline first. And then it seemed impossible to feel that the outline had to be filled in because the missing person, it's an empty space. And then later on it occurred to me that, of course, we represent ghosts as white outline shapes. So there's a certain cultural logic there that I wasn't aware of until it happened to me. When it happened, I just knew it was the thing to do. And in the beginning of the book, those people that are not responsive to the child are represented in black as black silhouettes.
Wow. There is this next page where the boy is sort of hugging himself, and we see that same white silhouette contained within his chest.
You're right. That's the same missing mom or teacher or other female figure that was so important to that child, that is so important to that child.
Julia Alvarez, what do you want kids to get out of reading this book?
I want them to feel accompanied. I just talked, and I know I've been gushing shamelessly about everybody involved in the book, but for me it was the community of putting this book together was really healing. And I think one of the things that grief does to us is that we feel, we just feel so alone with these questions. And if reading this book and looking at those images, a child, the child inside us, the child beside us can feel accompanied and understood in their loss, I think that's really important when we're grieving.
And Saberfield, what about parents or adults who are struggling to know how to talk to kids about this? What can this book bring to them?
Well, I hope it will bring to them an understanding that honesty is the best policy. And if you don't have the right answer, you puzzle it out together. You don't give an explanation that's fantastic. You know, when I was a child, children were not even taken to funerals. It was considered bad for them. And I think an honest confrontation on the fact that nobody knows where they go is better. It's maybe not religious, but it's spiritual.
Did you learn something about Julia's art form writing? And Julia, did you learn something about Sabra's art form in doing this book? And Sabra, you answer first.
Well, I really know from Julia's work and this poem in particular that less is more.
Less is more. Editing. And how about you, Julia? What did you learn about working on this book with Sabra?
Well, I have to say it just went beyond my expectations. You talked about that balloon image. I would never have thought of that, but it was just perfect. And it's so wonderful when you feel that synchronicity with an artist in another art form that what they are, her art is not handmaiden to the text. It's its own wonderful discovery. And to get the book enlarged that way was for me was wonderful. I mean, I just could not have imagined what Sabra did, but I must have intuited that she would know what to do with it.
Well, it's really remarkable in its shape, in its comfort, its humanity. You've done an amazing job here, both of you. Julia Alvarez and Sabra Field are the author and illustrator, respectively, of the new book for kids called Where Do They Go? Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Mitch.
Thank you, Mitch. And hope Jane feels better.
Oh, she will. She'll be back at it before you know it.
Love you too, Mitch.
Thank you so much. That is it for today. And tomorrow, should the country ditch the electoral college system and elect presidents based on the national popular vote? On the next Vermont Edition, we'll hear from local voices for and against. Send us your questions or comments at vermontedition@vpr.net and join us live tomorrow at noon. And join us next Wednesday for Vermont Edition's annual music show. Here's our request to you. Think about a memorable moment you had this year and what song helps tell that story. Many of you have responded already, and a lot of those responses are election-themed, which we understand, but we know there was life before November. We want to hear about that, too. So tell us a personal memory of 2016. What song reminds you of that event? Record your story on your smartphone or write to us and email vermontedition@vpr.net. We'll tell the stories and share the music of 2016 next Wednesday on Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertley. Thank you so much for listening today to Vermont Edition.